Today, in part 6 of our series, Stories to Live By, we examine the parable of the shrewd manager as presented in Luke 16. Just what does shrewd mean in this context? What are the three principles of stewardship? And what are the dangers of money? Here's Pastor Seth.
The parable that we're going to look at today, a very odd parable, one of the oddest that we think about. We think of it as the shrewd manager. If you've read this, you've probably shaken your head a few times and go, what is this about? Join the club. Jesus starts out in Luke 16. He said to his disciples, there was a rich man who had a steward, much like one of the parables we've looked at before. A rich man with a steward. The steward is charged with conducting the affairs of the rich man, sort of being his business associate, financial advisor, investor type of fella. There was a rich man who had a steward, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. Wasting his goods, what does that mean? Well, we really don't know exactly what that is and what was done. But apparently it was a serious deal because it, as we read on, it became what we would call a fireable offense. The rich man called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Are these rumors true, is the idea. Apparently they are. He says, turn in the account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. In other words, this is the end of the line for you. I can't believe that you would do whatever it was that you did with my money, that you would take advantage of the situation like that. It's pretty shocking. Now, in our day, if this happened, you would call somebody from HR. HR would come, get the steward, and you would hustle them right out the door, take their keys. And if they had to come back and get anything inside of their office, they would be escorted in to do that. Now, apparently in this day, there wasn't an HR department. They didn't escort him out of the building. The rich man gave the fella some time to find work. The steward said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the stewardship away from me? Now, it's sort of interesting that this fellow starts off in a bad light and gets worse. Whatever it was he did with the rich man's money was enough to get himself fired. But now as he looks at the situation, notice how he says this. He says that my master is taking the stewardship from me. In other words, I really didn't have anything to do with it. It seems like an arbitrary decision to let me go without even finding out more of the details. You just think of this guy just playing the victim card. And, you know, as you look at this, you just think, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this fella. What a scoundrel. What shall I do since my master has taken the stewardship away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. In other words, what he's thinking is, once the word gets out in the community about what I did with the master's money, nobody is going to take me on in a white-collar job. Not a chance of that going on. What am I going to do? Well, the next thing is a blue-collar job. But apparently the guy was frail or feeble or thought himself that, and the idea of digging ditches, I'm not strong enough to do that. And so the last thing he says, I'm too ashamed to beg, you know, get that piece of cardboard and, you know, I can't even put will work for food, just for food. But he's too ashamed of that. He doesn't want to do that. And so he's in a quandary. What am I going to do? He begins to think, verse 4. He thinks outside the box. I have decided what to do so that people may receive me into their houses when I am put out of the stewardship. So he's trying to think of a way, what can I do to somehow ingratiate myself with people who will still receive me with favor and perhaps be able to find some kind of position and some type of work? Now, what is it he's going to do? Now, if this was you, you would say, well, I need to start networking, get to know some new people, build friendships, build a lot of possibilities for future work. But this fellow doesn't have that kind of time to do that. Time is pressing. There's not enough time to network and get income. Well, who do I know then? Well, everybody I know in business are the fellows that I've worked with for the master. And there's not a chance of having business with them unless. And then voila, verse 5. So, summoning his master's debtors, one by one, he said to the first, what the guy does, he sets up a bunch of appointments in town. He goes from place to place, knocking on doors, some farmhouses, some shops, where the different people owe the master money. He goes to the first one. He says, how much do you owe my master? The fellow says, I owe 100 measures of oil. In that culture, that was a lot of debt. You wonder, how am I going to pay back 100 measures of olive oil? That's a lot of oil. The steward said to him, take your bill. I mean, here's the bill where you owe 100. Sit down quickly and write 50. In other words, here's the deal. I'll tell you what I'll do. You owe 100. Here's the bill that says you owe 100. But if you can pay 50 right now, we'll call that good. Debt paid. Now, you imagine the guy could hardly believe his ears. Oh my gosh. You mean I can get out of this debt? Think about if you had like $20,000 of credit card and somebody, credit card debt, and somebody said, well, we'll cut that in half just to start with. He would think, wow. That's something of what this guy would. He'd sit down and write 50. He couldn't wait to do that. 50 agreed. I'll pay that. Done. This fellow was happy as a lark to be out from under that debt. And so was the steward. He had made himself a friend. And the next one, he says, how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said, well, here's your bill. You're right. It says you owe 100. I tell you what. Can you come up with 80? If you can come up with 80, we'll call it even. Guy looks at him like, you're going to cut my bill by 20% what I owe? I can get out of 20% just by paying it now? Guy said, deal. Bill canceled. The guy and the fellow's thinking, man, I can't believe my good fortune. Thank you so much. What a good friend you are. He shakes the steward's hand, and the steward is quite happy because now he has two friends with whom he has ingratiated himself. And he goes from person to person doing that with all of the master's debtors. It's the kind of situation where at the end of the day, as he's done all this, you can sort of, at the end of each conversation, you can almost hear him inviting, hey, you know what we ought to do? At the end of the day, let's go down to the local saloon and at the happy hour. Let's go down to Chili's at happy hour. And 6 o'clock, drinks are on me. He tells this to everybody. 6 o'clock, all these guys show up, big party, and now this guy's like, hey, drinks are on me, picking up the bill. Probably the drinks were on the master. Now, you look at this guy, and you think, what a scuzzball. He starts out dishonest. We don't know if it was a criminal offense or civil offense. Might have been both. Blames his loss of the job on his master, and then he goes out and he still undercuts his master on financially. You think, man, what a no good low life this guy is. Now he's made friends, got all his allies all lined up. Now, here comes the twist in the parable. Verse 8. The master hears wind about what the fella had been doing all day with the debtors. And notice what the master says. The master commended the dishonest steward for his shrewdness. Now, this is a parable that Jesus is telling. Ostensibly, Jesus sort of plays the role of master here. There's something that's being commended here by the master, by the rich man, and by Jesus as he's talking to his disciples. And you think, what in the world is he saying? What does this parable mean? Now, as you think about this particular parable, it's important to look at what is being said and what is not being said. Okay. So what is he not saying? He's not saying the master commended the steward because of his great business ethics. Didn't say that. He's not saying the master commended the steward because he's a guy of high integrity. Not saying that. He's not saying that. That steward, I'm commending him because he's a trustworthy and faithful fellow. Not saying that either. In fact, Jesus is sure to put in an important adjective, and it's the word dishonest. The master commended the dishonest steward. So right at the first, we can say what he's not saying, what he's not commending about this guy is the guy's ethics or morals or how he behaved himself in the business world. None of that. He is clearly under the category of dishonest. What the master commends him for and what Jesus commends the disciples and you and me to do is one small sliver of this man's story. And we see it at the end of the verse. He commended the dishonest steward for his shrewdness. Now, in one sense, that may clear this parable up for you. In another sense, it may further bring more puzzlement to you. Are we supposed to be shrewd? Are the disciples supposed to be shrewd? Is that a good thing? What is it he's saying here about being shrewd? Now, in our particular culture, the word shrewd has gotten dumbed down to something horrific. Scandalous, or we think about it in terms of attorneys who double bill for their services, or sometimes we think of politicians and their shrewd political dealings and back behind walls, or you think about when I was growing up, Chicago politics was renowned for shrewdness. It has this image of sort of unscrupulous and dishonest. But originally, in the English language, the word shrewd meant discerning or astute. Shrewd means something of, it has the ability to ferret out in situations the things that are important and to let the things that are unimportant be put aside. Now, what is he saying here in this particular situation? What he's saying to the, what he's commending in the steward is this. This one sliver. This fella saw his future and the peril he was in, and he took immediate action to take care of it. He saw his future that was in peril and what needed to happen, and he took immediate action to do something about it. Now, when I think about what the steward didn't do, he didn't do what maybe you and I would have done. He didn't procrastinate. He didn't lollygag around. He didn't go home and just think, oh, woe is me. You know, what am I going to do? He just kind of sit around and just pout and mope and I can't believe life has been so terrible to me. He doesn't do any of those things. He is what Jesus calls shrewd. He thinks about his future and he's going to do something now in the present about it. That's what Jesus commends. That's what he's saying to the disciples through this parable. And then he says, speaking to the disciples, for the sons of this world, meaning unbelievers, are shrewder in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. Sons of light meaning God's people. As Jesus observes, he says, you know, sometimes God's people, we are really slow on this future present thing. We don't think that much about the future, and we don't really act that much in the present with an eye towards the future. What Jesus says, it seems like the people of this world do that more than you do. Now, nobody's ever thought of me as a world traveler, but I have visited missionaries in China, and we went to see Dave and Sean in Africa and Kenya years ago, and I've met some missionaries in Mexico and a few other places. And in every place that I've been overseas, I observe American businesses are there. Apparently, there are some American businessmen that qualify as shrewd in the good sense. They see the possibilities of a brighter future, what could be. They do their homework and research. Is there a need for this product? They're able to put some investment dollars together in order to do something about it. And then they act to make it happen, with the hope that their business will flourish and grow and meet the needs of people that are there. That's what Jesus is saying. He's sort of saying, I wish you guys as my followers would do the same thing. That you would think about your future and what could be and take action in the present to do something to make that even brighter. Verse 9. I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon. What in the world does he mean there? Now, mammon is usually the word for the umbrella term for money and material and possessions and stuff like that. And usually mammon in the Bible is used in an amoral way. Not immoral, but amoral. Neither good nor bad. It just depends on how you use it. It's a tool, like a stool. But here, in this, he says, he uses the adjective unrighteous mammon, which sort of hints at something. It's not that money is unrighteous, but the use of it may be. Make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon. Make friends for yourselves so that when it fails... How does money fail? Well, in our life, money sometimes fails because it doesn't live up to its billing. We thought we'd get that new car, man, we'd be just sitting behind that car for a lot of years, thinking, ah, what a great car I'm driving. And after about 2 or 3 months of that, you think about all the next 69 monthly easy payments you get to make on that car. And suddenly the luster and shine is not so bright as it once was. Well, you bought a room full of great living room furniture. Man, it's great. You got your kids over and they spill coffee on the couch, on the carpet. Dogs run through. What looked like, oh, this is going to be great, man. The place looks like a showroom. Now, not quite so much. But the way he's saying here is, again, with the future and present tense, certainly money is going to fail on the day you die. On that day, no matter how much you have in the bank, how much you have in your wallet, no matter what you have at your house, you ain't taking any of that with you. That's now a part of your past and my past. And it will be long gone. At that moment, you're going to wonder, how much attention did I give to all that stuff? How important was that? Then he says, make friends for yourselves. At the end of this verse, he says, that they may receive you into eternal habitations. What does he mean here? He's talking about coming attractions. You know, when you go to the movies, when I was a kid, I remember going to the movies, and one of the things I loved were all the trailers at the beginning. I didn't even know the word trailer. But I'd love to sit there and watch 7 or 8 or 10 of these things for 2 minutes, and you see all these, man, I want to go see that movie. Man, I want to go see that movie. I want to go see that movie. You know, now, you know, as an adult, you go to those things and you go, man, when is the movie going to come on? You know, so you're thinking, man, but of course, the people in the theater, they're not stupid. This is free advertising. You know, how much would you have to pay at a Super Bowl to run a 2-minute trailer for some movie? They get all this for free. You're sitting there with no place to go except eat more popcorn. Coming attractions. Because what they hope is that some of those trailers, you're going to go, hey, I'd like to see that. That looks like a movie worth going to. In other words, they appeal to something, a better future for you. And in the present, what you're going to do is register that in your mind. Or if you have a phone, you might even put it in your phone. Reminder, sure to see that movie. Coming attraction. This is what Jesus does here. Make friends for yourself. And the phrase, so that in eternal habitations they may be received. Now, what is he saying? He's saying something like this to his people. I want you to imagine a day when you leave this earth. And if you're a believer, you are ushered right into heaven. You walk through the gates. Now, the picture I want you to have of heaven is not the picture our secular culture gives you. Harps and clouds and boredom. Oh, my gosh. Never want to get my theology from secular culture. Bad idea. The Bible talks about a new heaven and a new earth in such a way that that place is going to be more real to us as believers than we think this place is. Even more real. Except with all the stuff that makes it bad here taken out. Imagine that. So you're in heaven. Let's say you're walking along, you're walking through the hills. You got trees over here, maybe aspen trees of Colorado, and their leaves are shimmering, yellowish, orange shimmering in the fall. Maybe you see some deer running over here. And you see a couple people very excitedly running up to you. And they say, hey, are you Doug? Are you Linda? You Patty? You're Lance, right? Yeah, I knew you when you had hair. We may have to edit that part out. Well, you don't know me. You don't know me. But I got to tell you, when you were at Pacific Church and you gave in the offering, 10% of what you gave and what the whole church gave went to missions, all kinds of mission causes around the world. And some of that money went to our foreign mission board. And some of that money helped pay for some missionaries in China where I lived. And somebody met me as a friend, befriended me, and shared the gospel. And I thought, wow, this is something of what I've been searching for all my life. My life changed. And now here I am, and you just walk in. Thank you so much for what you did. What you're going to see in somebody's eyes are tears. And gratitude. That says, what could I trade for what I have now? And what you're going to think about is that little bit of money that you gave a long time ago that you've even forgot about that had this kind of impact. Now, at that moment, when you think about that, there are going to be two people in tears. You mean, God, you could use me to make a difference in somebody's life through unrighteous mammon and being welcomed into eternal habitations, as Jesus says here? The principle is eternal joy for temporal giving. Something of far greater value and far more lasting value than almost anything I'm going to do with this money here. When I think about this, I think a bunch of verses come to mind, and probably to you too. 1 Corinthians 2:9. What no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man conceived, what you have prepared for us. The idea there is imagine. Go beyond what your imagination thinks about heaven. Or where Jesus says, if you give even a cup of cold water in my name, surely even that will be rewarded. You mean even something as small as that? Yes! Matthew 6:19-21. Jesus said, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust consume and where thieves break in and steal. That's a bad idea. Lay up treasures for yourself in heaven where neither moth nor rust consume and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Same idea. Or Jesus talking to the disciples and he says to them, I tell you the truth, anybody who's had to say goodbye to brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, houses and lands, will have 100 times more coming down the pike. Hard to get that kind of return on investment. 2 Corinthians 4:16-18. We looked at this verse either a week or two ago. Paul says, therefore we do not lose heart, because outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes, not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. What is seen is temporal, but what is unseen is eternal. That's the same message of this parable. The shrewd manager. Or 2 Timothy 4:7-8. Paul, at the end of his life, in a Roman prison for his faith, about to die, looks back on his life. He says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness which the Lord will award to me and to all who have loved his appearing. Same idea. So now I think, dear diary, I think I need to think about this thing. What is maturity? Maybe it's different than what I thought. Maybe instead of a whole bunch of experiences of feeling close to you, maybe what you're doing in this world is creating a deeper thirst in me that goes in some different directions. A thirst that wants to rebuff temptation, not just has to rebuff temptation. Maybe a thirst to stay engaged with the things of God and with the people of God during those times that sometimes get so discouraging. Maybe a thirst to persevere through disappointment. And a thirst to endure even through times where it seems like, is it futile? And maybe a thirst to honor you no matter what it costs. Maybe that's what maturity looks like. When I think about 1 Corinthians 13, what we call the love chapter, I think about the ending of it. It says, faith, hope, and love abide these three. You know, God, as a young Christian, I put a lot of stock in faith, and I know you do. And I put a lot of stock in love, and I know you do. But I remember when I was a younger Christian, this idea of hope seemed like, But now it seems like this is what you're trying to say through this very strange parable. What's the real source of my hope? Is my hope really rooted in what I'm going to get out of today? Or is my hope really rooted in what's coming, in coming attractions? Then he goes on and explains a few other verses that are a little bit more familiar to us. Verse 10. He who is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much. He who is dishonest in a very little is dishonest in much. So what I take here is that he's going to have a few verses where he says, okay, if you catch this, disciples, this thing of future, coming attractions, present action, as you think about what you're doing with money and your resources, let's start here. If you're faithful in a very little, you'll be faithful in much. You know, we've had the big lottery thing, you know, about a month ago. People out there buying tickets, you know, just all this hullabaloo. Sometimes I hear Christians say, man, if I won the lottery, I'd tithe off of it. Right. Jesus says, if you won't do it when you got just a little bit, you won't do it when you got a lot. We start there. If then... well, I just don't have that much to give. That's the place to start. Verse 11. If then you've not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will entrust you the true riches? You say, well, golly, I want to be involved in helping people. I want to make a difference with people. Jesus would say, great. But before I entrust people to you, how are you doing with something like unrighteous mammon? If you do well there, I'll gladly entrust people to you. Verse 12. If you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Okay, so we have some folks that come to our church, and they've been big players in another church, big leaders, and they come, and I want to lead out in this ministry. And I never, that I can ever think of, say, great. That's a bad idea, in my opinion. Because what I want to see first is this principle put to use. If you can be a part of somebody else's ministry and help them to move things forward as a follower, then perhaps I'm ready to entrust you with leadership, with people. Verse 13, no servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. We try to ride the fence. He says, impossible. You try to ride the fence, what's going to win is money in your heart because of the nature of our heart. We want the immediate. We want to see what we can get. That's going to win. So there's no riding the fence on this thing. Now, the Pharisees were listening to this, verse 14. who were lovers of money heard this, all this, the parable and these principles, and they scoffed at it. They said, right, you got to be kidding. The unrighteous steward, shrewd, you think that story makes any sense to us? You're commending that guy? These verses here on stewardship, scoffed. There, what they said was something like this. The future? The future will come. It'll take care of itself. All I really care about is right now. What am I going to get now? How am I going to feel now? That's all that matters. Why? Because they were lovers of money. Verse 15. He said to them, you are those who justify yourselves before men and rationalize anything. God knows your hearts. What is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. Shrewd. You see a future that's preferable. Coming attractions. And you do something in the present to make it sparkle all the more. There was a lady who went to heaven. She had tried to ride the fence of God and money. She gets to heaven. She's so excited to be there. Saint Peter meets her at the gate. Well, man, we're checking on your file before we can place you in your mansion. Okay, I'm not in a hurry. Ready to go. Finally comes back and they put her in a golf cart. They take her through the posh sections of heaven. Big mansions and estates. And she's thinking, wonder which one is mine. Cart keeps on going down to the Newport Beach scene of heaven. This is pretty good. I like the view here. Keeps on going. Makes its way out into the slums. Out into the shacks. The corrugated tin and green plastic. No front except a blanket. Thing comes to a stop. Peter says, well, here you go, man. This is your place. Well, there must be some mistake. This can't be the mansion that I was looking forward to. And Peter says to her, ma'am, we did the best we could with the materials you sent forward. That lady was not shrewd. But you and I, we can be. If we will, let's pray. Father, I pray that we would hear what you're saying to us in this little parable. That you would give us eyes to see, the eyes of faith, and particularly the eyes of hope. That we are a people who live not just for this world, or as Paul said, if our hope is just in this world, we are of all men to be most pitied. The Lord, coming attractions. Coming attractions. And we have a chance to put what's on the screen.